This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. In the studio with me, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist for his, you know, weekly show. I mean, it hasn't been quite very weekly. Active. Where were you last week?
I was in Singapore just down the coast, Causeway, you know.
Attending some concert, I suppose.
No, conference. Concert's tomorrow. Mick Jagger coming to Asia.
George, you got tickets for Mick Jagger?
I have.
How?
eBay. Have you heard of that website?
So, oh, did you like God. Pay 10 times more for
not
it?
Nearly. Sometimes out of desperation, you have to do something like that. It's on my bucket list.
Really?
Yeah.
How long is this bucket list?
It's 100 things in there. I've done about
just
20.
Just under the category of concert, how many?
One more. I know it's very boring. Barbara Streisand and Celine Dion and that sort of, and Beyonce. We'll never see them in Asia, will we?
Well, don't be too sure.
I don't know.
Come to Singapore. I mean, you fly all over the place, don't you, to see these people?
No, it's just one of those things that you've got to do.
Conveniently not turn up for the show every now and again.
All right, I've been told off now. We're talking about something very, very important today.
It is.
So not talking about Mick Jagger at all, even though I wrote an article about Mick Jagger.
And, you know, forget about all of that now. We're going to be discussing something really interesting.
Extremely important.
Well, it was reported all over the place, actually.
Absolutely. It's one of those most important kind of findings in scientific journal
correct.
That may change the landscape of medicine.
About DNA testing, right?
That's correct, yes.
Our phone lines are going to be open. It's 0377109000. Yeah. You can tweet BFM Radio. Or you can text 016-201-9000. In the studio with us as well is Professor Dr. Teo Soo Hwang. She's the Chief Executive Officer of CARIF, the Cancer Research Initiatives Foundation. And there's a very good reason why we brought her in today. How are you today?
I'm very good. Hi, Meera.
I finally got her on.
I know. She's a very busy person.
Extremely.
Exactly. Finally. We have that privilege, you know. Soo Hwang and I, we've known each other for a while. And then we went to, I think we matriculated in the same year in Cambridge, right?
We did.
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic.
You're going to reveal how old we are, George?
No, I'm not concerned about that. How did you put up with him?
No, right.
I'll need all night to tell you that, Meera.
That's right. Okay.
Once a week is bad enough.
It is bad enough, right? But the thing is that, you know, this is a very important subject, and I really am privileged in order to get Soo Hwang here to tell us about the good work she's doing, and then also congratulations on all the publications that you have achieved so far,
yes.
And nomination for Medeca Award.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Most of us haven't heard of Soo Hwang. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how did you land in CARIF, the Cancer Research Initiatives Foundation?
Well, CARIF is a non-profit cancer research organisation. There's a Malaysian organisation trying to do research in Malaysia for the benefit of Malaysian cancer patients. So I'm rather embarrassed to be sitting next to George to have his recommendations. But in truth, we're a very small, simple organisation that seeks to conduct research to find better ways of preventing as well as treating cancers. So in the area of predisposition, we have been making an impact largely in breast cancer, where we've been looking at the role of genes such as BRCA1 and BRCA2 in breast cancer in Malaysia. And we're the people who offer the genetic counselling and genetic testing similar to what Angelina Jolie has. Mm-hmm. So in this respect, BRCA1 and BRCA2 also increases risk to prostate cancer. So men who have in the families that have breast and ovarian cancer come to us for counselling and genetic testing to figure out what is their risk of developing prostate cancer. And that's, I suppose, the context in which George has brought me here today.
That's right. George, I mean, just before I come back to the whole DNA thing, Professor, you have said that most men would die with prostate cancer.
No, I said most men would probably have the diagnosis of prostate cancer, but very small number of men will die of prostate cancer.
That's right. So they'll probably die with rather than of.
That's correct.
Prostate
yes.
cancer. So if that's the case, I mean, why is it such a big problem?
Well, it is a huge problem, right? Okay, so the things that I would like the public to probably participate in this discussion is I would like to pose a question. Modern medicine, is this a source of certainty or is this the absolute generation of anxiety? Yeah. I'll give you a scenario about prostate cancer. You know, I'm obviously a urologist. I see patients who go for screening tests all the time. So if I give you an example of Mr. Lim, for example, you know, went for a screening test at the age of 55, and his blood test showed that his PSA is 4.72, mm-hmm. for example. And the cutoff point on his blood forms actually says 4 and above equals cancer. So this is modern technologies, right? And modern technologies that tells him that it is abnormal. You need to see a urologist. It's cancer until proven otherwise. So he will come up to see me. I will give him some reassurance. I will actually just, you know, examine his prostate and so on and so forth. And then, you know, sometimes, obviously, men are a little bit worried about having biopsy and so on and so forth. And I will probably give him some antibiotics to see whether that PSA will come down. If it comes down, then he'll ask me another question and say, is this cancer or not? Mm-hmm. And then that is the biggest questions that we ask all the time. So what I'm trying to say is that PSA is specific to prostate as an organ, but not necessarily, you know, specific for cancer. So, you know, this sort of test will generate some degree of anxiety. For many men, you're in this conundrum because you are now opened the Pandora's box because of modern medicine. In 1980s and before, PSA didn't exist. And then so now the PSA exists. It's not a good test, but it's the best test we have. And that puts a lot of men in this conundrum. And then so I'm sure many listeners out there, you have done your, you know, Steve Jobs CA19-9 test, you have done CEA and all sorts of things. And a bit of rise, does it tell you it's cancer? Does it not tell you it's cancer? What sort of anxiety does it cause for you? So modern medicine, source of certainty or generations of anxiety? I think that is a good topic to discuss.
Professor, could you just go through with me, as opposed to the PSA and the sort of DNA testing that you do, what's the difference?
So essentially the difference is detecting disease now and detecting risk of disease in the future. So if you have a genetic test, effectively what you're trying to do is predict whether someone is going to get disease in the future, even in, and this is something that you've inherited from your mother or your father, and something that you cannot change. So that doesn't necessarily mean that disease will happen in the future. It just gives you a probability that the disease will happen. Whereas for a test such as PSA, which is a specific marker or prostate-specific antigen, then this is a test which detects an abnormality. It detects something which is secreted by, or in other cases, detected by the immune system that detects the cancer being present. The trouble, as George has accurately pointed out, is that it's not very specific. So in other words, out of 10 people that have an elevated PSA, maybe one of those would be cancer and the others will not. Or maybe one of those will be aggressive cancers and the others will be indolent cancers that just take their time, don't do anything and don't go anywhere. Yeah. The trouble is you can't tell the difference. And that's where the key in research is, trying to tell the difference between the men that you can have to say your PSA may be 4.72, like George said, but in 3 years you may die from prostate cancer because you have the aggressive time, versus your PSA is 4.72. But actually, on the basis of a genetic test, you don't have high risk of developing the aggressive type of cancer, and therefore we would say we'll watch and wait and watch and see what happens next.
Well, at this stage, both sound like probabilities as well.
It is. I mean, it's like a very, very famous father of modern medicine, someone called William Osler, famously used to say, medicine is an art of uncertainty and also a science of probability. You know, he was described in his 1849, essentially, you know, it is an art, but yet it's a science because it's all about probability. And that is why I think modern medicine, with all these technology, even down to the accuracy of DNA testing and things like that, it's all down to probability. And that itself sometimes may generate some degree of anxiety in somebody. So before you embark on anything, I really need to think that, I would think that you need to know whether this is something that is a certain degree of certainty, or is this something that is going to cause you anxiety? Because we see people who get all these blood tests done and then they really are worse off for knowing, you know, what does that mean in the future? What do you think? You know, Suwan, do you think that, Osler kind of described that it is an art of uncertainty, but yet it's a science of probability? You know, at the end of the day, this article that came out in BBC News says that DNA prostate test will predict the deadliest cancer risk. You know, obviously we're moving away from the PSA. PSA. But at the end of the day, it is still probability, isn't it?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Science is still an estimation at best. And what we're trying to do is give you more accurate probabilities. But the difficulty for a patient in front of you is you are either, there's no probability. For
That's
you, you
right.
either have disease, it's a one or a zero.
I know.
You either have disease or you don't. So to try and tell a patient you have an 80% chance, I'm like, well, what is 80%? How does that relate to me? Am I in the 20% or am I in 80%?
80%, exactly.
All patients want certainty. Nobody wants uncertainty.
So, especially when it comes to cancer, you either have it or you don't.
Yeah.
So if you just imagine a life of a urologist going through so many layers of uncertainty, first of all, the PSA is uncertain, all right? Because you don't know whether 4 is a cutoff for you or not, because below 4 doesn't mean you haven't got cancer. Above 4 certainly doesn't mean you have got cancer. Yeah. The next layer of a biopsy, a negative biopsy doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have cancer. Obviously, the positive biopsy is the good indications that something is wrong. The third layer of uncertainty actually is that even if you have cancer, you don't necessarily may die from prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. So that's the third layer of uncertainty. So this is the reason why Suwang is doing fantastic work, with CARIF and then, pushing forward the frontier of science, flying the flag for Malaysia in order to, contribute to our understanding of this DNA testing and how much is that going to change the face of medicine.
Professor Teo, how did you feel when you read about this latest revelation about DNA testing and, it can actually predict men who face the highest risk of deadly prostate? And I think that's the key here. I think your challenge is trying to pick out the men who have the aggressive
form. I want certainty.
You want to pick up the tiger tumor rather than the pussycat tumor.
You just got it absolutely right. It's absolutely, picking out the cancer that's going to actually kill somebody. Because like you said, from the very beginning, that cancer, most people are going to die with prostate cancer, not necessarily of prostate cancer. So, what Suwang's work and his department is trying to answer that question, and that is the holy grail.
Were you excited at all?
Well,
do you think this is only going to mislead people even more like Angelina Jolie did,
No, I think the reason why there's a lot of confusion within the field is because at least in Malaysia, there are many companies that are out there selling tests directly and the field is very unregulated. So to add on to the three uncertainties that George talks about where these are credible tests, what actually happens in many parts of the world is that the genetic testing is not regulated and therefore there's a lot of even unregulated testing that's going out there that says, oh, you should have this blood test and then we'll detect a
So we have a fourth tier of uncertainty.
Absolutely.
Now.
And these individuals
are out
there.
That's the reason why I don't believe in these tests.
All right.
Yeah. So they're out there selling these tests that effectively is very often coupled to some kind of sales of supplement or diet. So in other words, we'll do a test to say what is your risk. And then on the basis of that, oh, you're at elevated risk, so please take this bowl of supplements that will cost you $1,000.
An arm and a leg,
1,000 ringgit a month in order to reduce your risk. And none of that is evidence-based. In the first place, the test wasn't correct. Yeah. The accuracy wasn't correct. And the call in terms of whether you can change your risk on the basis of a supplement is not evidence-based. So that is a major challenge that we need to address. So Dr. Sophia, as well as Professor Ross Eales, are people that we collaborate with. We've been working with them very closely on prostate cancer that occurs in men with BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations. Prof. Azad, as well as Dr. Jasmine Lim in University of Malaya, have recently started contributing to the Malaysian component of that international study to look at aggressive prostate cancer and hopefully to identify new genes that cause an increased risk to prostate cancer. But the underlying thing that we need to recognize is that PSA testing in this country still has got very little evidence that it helps. So if you look at populations, yes, there is an ability of PSA testing when you open it up widely to many individuals that you downstage cancer. So in other words, rather than detecting cancer at a late stage, you start to detect cancer in the early stage. Similar for breast cancer. Mammography, rather than detecting in the late stage, you start to detect in the early stage. And the mantra that we all believe is that early detection saves lives. But as treatment options are improving, scientists as well as doctors are starting to question that. So in other words, if you are whether early screening is actually detecting the lesions that may go away on its own or not is a huge challenge. So, both of you have really put a nail, you know, hit the nail on the head by asking, how do we understand which ones are aggressive and which ones are not?
Right.
If you talk to any prostate cancer patient, they'll say, well, PSA testing saved my life. I didn't know that prostate cancer exists, but because I have elevated PSA, I went for a test and they detected the cancer, and now I'm here because it was treated. Mm-hmm. But if you behind every prostate cancer patient who says that, there'll be 20 others.
In fact, there's statistic done already that is that behind every man saved from prostate cancer, there's 1,000 anxiety that's created for false positive. That's right.
You know, and that brings me back to pathologist Richard Ablin, who discovered the PSA antigen in 40 years ago, and he says it should never have been used as a cancer screening tool for all men. And when I read that, I'm thinking, what's going on here?
It's in all fairness, PSA is the only test we have. I mean, in 1970, when Ablin actually, you know, tested this in experiment and things, it was used in the first rape case in order to see whether there's any semen inside the actual rape case, and they find whether PSA exists or not, because PSA is tissue specific. What it means is that it exists only in prostate and nothing else. In fact, actually it exists in milk, in human milk. But apart from that, it's organ specific. But when PSA rises, it could be because one ejaculated the night before, or it could be because one is on cycling trip, and something like that can actually push up your PSA.
Thank you, John. Should have told us that much earlier.
No, that's right.
The do's and don'ts before you go for
a
PSA
exactly.
test.
Or if you have your rectum examination, that might push up your PSA test.
LTY, how are you today?
Good afternoon again, and good afternoon, Dr. George.
LTY.
Good afternoon, Professor Pyok.
Yeah.
Good afternoon.
How are you today? Okay?
Very well, thank you.
I have two questions, Professor Pyok. I think I addressed to Professor Pyok.
Okay.
In the first case, why do cell mutate? Okay? Why do cell mutate? My second question is, according to a laboratory study, They found that a type of fatty acid, which is, I think, called 12-MTA, and this fatty acid has a tendency to inhibit or at least delay the growth of a prostate cell. Can you elaborate a bit, Professor Teo?
Okay, LTY, before you go.
Josh,
yeah.
I answer your question, okay?
Okay.
The more research done, the better.
The more research done, the better. That goes without saying.
Yeah. And this will reduce the probability, all right?
Okay, wait. You can't go just yet. You can't just ask me a question and I don't get to ask you a question. Okay, because while Professor Teo is composing a thesis to answer your question, that's right, let me ask you a question, right? You know, I asked the Klang Valley listeners to say modern medicine, source of anxiety or source of certainty. What's your answer?
Okay, I give you a simple answer. We have to live with it, okay? We have to live with it, okay?
That means you're not answering the question.
Thank you, LTY. Oh, well.
So LTY had two questions, very, very, very important questions. So he touched on A, mutations being the driver of why normal cells become cancer cells. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what is the source of mutations? Well, the source of mutations is different for different types of cancers. So for cancers such as lung cancer, colon cancer, skin cancer, the sources are lifestyle factors. So for lung cancer, obviously, it's tobacco. For colon cancer, it is primarily red meat and lack of fruits and vegetables. And for skin cancer, it is UV from the skin, from sunlight and other sources. If you look at the other cancers, then which ones are more common, then there'll be the viral sources of oncogenes or changes in cells. So viral cancer-induced cancers would include things like cervical cancer and liver cancer and nasopharyngeal cancer. So if you then look at the remaining top 10 cancers, the only ones that are left are the hormone-related cancers. So in other words, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, prostate cancer, endometrial cancer. So you have to ask yourselves, why do these cancers, why are they in the top 10? Why do they exist? Why are we worried about them? Unfortunately, we were made this way. So the truth is...
So like he said, you have to live with it.
Absolutely, you have to live with it.
Even more if you're a woman, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a very hormonal...
Now. It's like, I'm defending for men here.
One prostate cancer. It happens to be the same gene, isn't it, as breast cancer.
So it depends on your view on life. If we believe that that you are, in a sense, you're here to procreate, then effectively we shouldn't really exist anymore once we have had our children. And, whereas now humans, because of modern medicine, we live to a ripe old age of 86 and above. I think that's average life expectancy for a Chinese woman in Malaysia is in their 80s now.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, Swan, you mentioned all those things, right? I just suddenly realized that the bigger picture has got it all sus, really. They said the source of a cancer, it's either environmental, or you can't blame the environment, just blame the genes. Just blame your parents.
It's the hormones, isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
It's your hormones.
You just blame, they always just say, over here, they just kind of ask all these questions about all these sources, or, all these problems in life. If you can't blame the environment, you just blame your parents.
No, I didn't say that. Then you said
that's
that.
That's right. Okay.
So coming back to the hormonal ones, then it's actually unfortunately part and parcel of life, which is why mutations become more common as you grow older, or cancers become more common as you grow older, because you've had more chance through your life to accumulate the mutations and accumulate the chance, back to probability, of developing a cancer. But recently, there was a very, very nice study that was published in Nature last year from... Actually, the first author is a Malaysian. So Nick Zainal is a Malaysian medical geneticist working at the University of Cambridge. And she was able to show, together with a large team at Mike Stratton's lab at the Wellcome Trust, that a major source of mutations may actually be an enzyme that is produced in normal cells. So this is an enzyme called ApoBac3b that just somehow induces a particular mutation signature in some cells. And the race is on at the moment to look to see whether by targeting ApoBac3b, perhaps you have found ways in which we might be able to prevent a major source of mutations and perhaps find new ways in which we can prevent cancer. And this is an area that we are certainly going into in CARIF. Then the second question in regards to supplements
acids.
And fatty acids and vitamins and other things that can prevent cancer, I think we really need to look at how the research was done. Unfortunately, the gold standard for how to do this type of research is to do large studies where you can follow up patients for a very, very long time to figure out whether a particular dietary intake would actually reduce or increase risk to cancer. And there are only two large studies that are able to do this. And I encourage LTY to have a look at them. So have a look at EPIC. EPIC is a large European preventative study in nutrition and looking at dietary impact on cancer. And these recruited 500,000 Europeans across, I think, 10 or 11 countries in the 1990s. And only now is the data coming out in terms of what dietary intake actually modulates or increases or decreases risk to cancer. So this, from that study, they have really looked at a large number of variables. And I think the ones there, I would trust. Anything else that says, I can kill cancer in the dish in the lab,
because it needs to be prospective over a long period
absolutely.
Of time.
And even this research that we're using for the base of this show today, George, is a sample of 191
that's
men.
That's right, okay.
So I was thinking, what has George picked up here? 191 men.
Well, the thing is that since the treatment of prostate cancer is filled with so many uncertainty, any degree of lead that can help us to find that holy grail, to make anything more certain, to get rid of PSA is extremely valuable. It's a gold mine. All the companies...
It's part of the jigsaw puzzle.
It is. It is. And therefore, that 140... In fact, the study is actually quite simple. You just find out those people who have got genetic reasons why they develop prostate cancer at earlier stage, and those cancers are more aggressive type of cancer. And then you find out exactly what sort of genetic makeup, a DNA makeup that they have, and those other makeup potentially may contribute towards predicting what other people may have. And it's as simple as that. So you're right, it's 147 people, it's but at the end of the day, this is the only lead we have to find this holy grail.
I don't believe it. Is he right, Professor?
But Mira, I think this, George,
because he's just projecting it 191 across the whole population. Is that correct?
I think the key is this study was actually done in families that had three or four more members of their family affected. So it's a very, very different, very, very different setting. Because in this setting, you know that you already have some genetic predisposition within your family that puts you at higher risk. The reality is, if you are, if you have a sister, if you have watched, like Angelina Jolie, part of the reason why she went was motivated to go for a genetic test is because she watched her mother have ovarian cancer and suffer from it. I believe she also had an auntie that suffered from breast or ovarian cancer. I can't remember which one it was. But if you're a family member, a close family that has member that's been affected by cancer, you are understandably worried about your own risk. You need to know if PSA testing is ever going to help me, if any other genetic testing is going to help me, because it helps you get some measure of closure. Yes, you're still dealing with probability, but that probability helps you determine closure. Because sometimes families who have seen multiple members of their family have breast cancer, they'll say, well, you know, I'm not going to get married and I'm not going to have children. But it might turn out that they never inherited that same gene.
Actually, the interesting things about this is that it's actually very personal. So the doctor need to guide the patient to actually say that when you do this test, and then this is what it tells you, the chances of you developing certain X cancer is X percentage. And that's what we're talking about here, because at the end of the day, it is consent. It is informed consent. If you don't really know what you get yourself into, then you get more into this some degree of uncertainty and a lot of anxiety as a result of that.
We're discussing DNA testing and prostate cancer. We want to know how you feel. Give us a call. The number 0377 109 000. Do you think modern medicine has provided some degree of certainty, or has it brought about more anxiety? That number again, 0377 109 000.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. It's The Bigger Picture and I'm Mira Savasudhi. In the studio with me, Professor Dr. Teo Soo Hwang, Chief Executive Officer of the Cancer Research Initiatives Foundation, better known as CARIF, and of course, Dr. George Lee in the studio with me for his weekly show. He hasn't even been around last week. He's planned to disappear again in 2 weeks' time.
No, don't mention that.
He's watching the Rolling Stones tomorrow, Professor.
No, I'm not an El Divo kind of person. I'm a Mick Jagger kind of person. Wrong era, probably. That's right. I was born in the 60s. Right?
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. You're old.
Very old.
Our phone lines are open, 0377 109 000. We're discussing prostate cancer and DNA testing. We want to know whether you think modern medicine has provided us some degree of certainty, or has it just contributed towards more anxiety? Well, Mr. G says, modern medicine is the only choice we have at the moment. Any data is better than no data.
Well put. It's so well put, isn't it?
Besides, I won't depend on traditional medicine for cancer. Does that make sense? Of course it does.
Well, it does make sense, because perfect that's sense. The only, if that's the only hope you have, what else do you have? You know, so you have to, so therefore, like what LTY says, you have to live with it, but yet we have to have more research. That's where, you know, Suhan comes in. You know, it's amazing. What two things I learned today is that, you know, the amount of work collaborations that they're doing, you know, internally, you know, within Malaysia, within Klang Valley, with all the universities, in order to collaborate with international researchers is phenomenal. And the other thing which is amazing is that we have Malaysian working in Wellcome Trust in Cambridge. We just need to collaborate more with them and then bring them back. And then perhaps we might be the one who find the real answer, the real Holy Grail.
That's right. You know, Professor, you yourself, I was reading an article where you said scientific discoveries, you'll find that less than 5% of these studies are actually conducted in Asia. So how much of this can we actually depend on?
Well,
as large as it can be, but how representative is it of the Asian population?
Probably that all that 5% is at CARIF.
That's exactly what I was thinking, right? Who is actually doing research in this side of the world?
So there are a number of centres that do this, but it is what you and George have pointed out is true. There are very, very few studies in Asia. There are some big studies in Shanghai, but in Southeast Asia, Malaysia is one of the main centres where we can do this type of work, and CARIF is certainly making a lead in this direction together with collaborators in University of Malaya.
But I think down to money, isn't it?
It does absolutely boil down to money. So CARIF is a non-profit cancer research organisation, and we're delighted to have supporters who come and buy t-shirts from us for the Terry Fox run, and who
but
come
that cannot
and
be enough.
Not at all.
Well, that gets you. What gets you a pipette?
You're making fun of her.
George and I go way back, so it's okay. Right.
So I'm all right. I'm all right to do that. That's the reason why we have this airtime, in order to persuade people to say, look, Malaysia is doing great work, and then, you know, just contribute.
But we need the money, right?
Yeah. We absolutely do need the money. I think it's not just the money. So certainly money is very, very critical. And as George has pointed out, you know, we receive and are very grateful for donations all the time. But we also need people to come and take part in our research studies. Help us to find out more about breast cancer by contributing your time in filling out our questionnaires and donating a blood sample for research, and volunteering for our events to make them more successful. And in talking about cancer, so we have a campaign called the Be Frank campaign that's trying to raise awareness about cancer. And we just need hands and bodies and voices to help us raise awareness about cancer and hopefully reduce the fear about cancer out there. So coming back to the topic of why genetic testing is important, I think we all want a screening test. You know, our ideal is to have a test that is 100% accurate, 100% sensitive, 100% specific, cheap, affordable. You can do once
not
in your
cheap,
life.
Free.
That too.
And painless.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what we want. We want a blood test, or ideally a spit sample that can tell us all that we need to know about ourselves at any one time.
Yeah. Do you think that's ever going to be possible?
No.
In the future? No. Never. That's a definite no,
what
isn't
a
it?
A saliva test.
No. Like, you know, a test that is it's
everything
so
that you
utopic.
Want it to be.
You know, it's just like in a world of utopia, this is going to, a spit can just tell you up to 100% accuracy. But life is not accurate, right?
No, it's not.
Absolutely
and
not.
And we need to control world population anyway.
Mira.
You can't live to 255 okay, right. Like you had planned.
So the reality is we're not there. So if you're a public health person, you want to be able to say, okay, does this test, if I apply it to 100,000 people, will it be able to pick out the 100 people that have cancer, for example, but not pick out, not tell anyone else falsely that they may have cancer when actually they don't? The reality is that there are very, very few tests that are able to do that. There are very few tests that have the specificity that's high enough to not make lots of people worry unnecessarily about a disease that they don't. At the same time, what we also want to know is which tests will help improve survival, because there's no point having something earlier detected if ultimately your goal is the point of having earlier detection is overall survival. So does a test actually improve overall survival? And the number of screening tests that actually improve overall survival is very low. So we're really at a very, if you like, you can turn it around and say we're at a terrible position overall. But I would argue that we're not. The reality is we can prevent 30% of cancers and we do nothing about it.
Really?
So there's a silence in the room. We're all like thinking, we can all prevent 30% of cancers. And do we do anything about it? The reality is no. We're all chasing this utopia of a single spit that can help us know whether we have cancer. So 30% of cancers comes from A, stop smoking. Mm-hmm. B, eat the right things, i.e.
Oh no, I've
reduce.
Heard this all before. And it's hard work.
It is absolutely hard work. And then exercise.
Yes,
exercise,
I do them all.
Exercise. So that's
I do them
the
all
difficult.
Once a year.
That's right. Shame on you.
That's right. Yeah.
But where do genetic tests come in? So the reality is that genetic tests do help us to ultimately profile who is at really high risk of disease versus who is at moderate risk, and then who is at much lower risk. And where we're going in the future is going to be maybe a scenario more likely to be one in which you take a blood test, you determine what disease you're actually at risk of, and then for the disease that you're at risk for, you go for screening for those diseases. So at the moment for breast cancer, for example, using a genetic test, if we were to hypothetically do a genetic test on everyone in the population, we would find that something like 40% of the population accounts for about 60% of the cancers. If we get to a point at which 80% of the cancers arise from 20% of the population, then what you're going to say is, actually, I don't need to screen 80% of the population. I need to screen the 20% that are going to account for most of the cancers. And I think that's where genetic testing may have a role from a public health perspective. But from an individual perspective, we're not there yet. Absolutely not there yet.
Mm.
And that's what most people want to know. They want to know, on for me, What does it mean to me?
That's right. Yeah. For me, does that mean that I pay X amount of money and then I will know all these data? And how does that help me?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, which is what this data shows, because the BBC prostate test, you know, the headline says will predict deadliest cancer risk. And then the researcher actually said, I can see in 2 to 3 years offering screening to men with prostate cancer and to men who worry about their family history might be within reach. Do you seriously think that, you know, we are kind of like a in that sort of like scenario in 2-3 years time? For me, that person will walk into a shop and then actually just find out exactly where do they stand in terms of risk in the future for prostate cancer.
I think for prostate cancer, it's actually a lot more realistic than we think.
Oh, okay.
Largely because,
really?
Yes.
Okay.
So there's a really exciting group that I'm part of that's called Practical, and another one that's called CAC. So this is a clinical ellipse collaboration that is led by some of the top urologists in the UK. So people like David Neil in Cambridge and others, who've really been collecting cohorts of patients that have long clinical follow-up. So in other words, they have sequential samples from these patients. They know which ones develop cancer, which ones don't, which ones develop aggressive cancers and which ones don't. So by using these markers, which were identified in a very small group of patients, only 191 patients, in less than a year, they will be able to figure out whether this is also true in a separate cohort, and then from there do the prospective studies. So these are called retrospective studies, but I'm optimistic that there will be real tangible data that will come up from the retrospective analysis in not too distant future, because the cohorts are now there, the big cohorts are now there, and we should be able to address at least whether this is promising enough to say let's start testing them in large populations.
Is it promising enough to start doing BRCA tests for breast cancer? Are you there yet?
Absolutely. I think for...
A lot of people are having BRCA tests for breast cancer already now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But even in Malaysia.
But in terms of when you say promising, are you there yet? Do you think the test actually is promising enough?
I'm pausing because I think the word promising needs to be qualified. So I think
it's
if
subjective.
You, absolutely. If you are a family, you go back again to individuals that have family members, they have seen family members suffer from breast, ovarian, prostate cancers and see, and then they are asking themselves, am I going to be next? They want some closure, some certainty. Is the reason why cancer occurred in my family due to this? And if I have a genetic test, will I know for certain whether that's the case or not? So I think in that circumstance, then I think genetic testing, genetic counselling appropriately, as well as genetic testing will play a very major role. But then if you are an individual that doesn't have any cancer in your family, you are 45 and you are married with 3 kids, etc., there's no reason to suspect that you're at elevated risk. Then in those circumstances, there's no reason for that, for that type of genetic counselling or genetic testing. In a circumstance where you are, for example, an ovarian cancer patient and you have had several lines of chemotherapy that has stopped to work, then there's now a new therapy that has been submitted for FDA approval in the United States called olaparib, that's a PARP inhibitor, that's been specifically developed to target the cancers that arise from individuals that have BRCA mutations. And this offers real new hope. So in other words, potentially this is an area where we can cure the cancers because of understanding what genes are mutated within. So BRCA testing isn't just for you to be able to predict what is your future risk of cancer, but it may influence in the future what treatment you are given if you are affected by cancer. And I think this is promising. To me, it is promising.
Fantastic. We're discussing genetic testing and prostate cancer with Professor Dr. Teo Soo Huang, and she's the Chief Executive Officer of CARIF, together with, of course, Dr. George Lee. If you have a question for them, send it through. The number is 03-77-109-000. That's the phone line. If you'd like to give us a call, you can text 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. It's Mira Sivasuthi, Dr. George Lee, a consultant urologist in the studio with me, together with Professor Dr. Teo Soo Huang, Chief Executive Officer of the Cancer Research Initiatives Foundation. And trust me, CARIF is actually here based in Malaysia. Nothing that's, you know, based abroad. I think what I found quite interesting is the death rate from prostate cancer has fallen by 20% in the past 20 years, according to cancer research in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And the charity says that early diagnosis and new treatments such as hormone therapy and radiotherapy are behind this trend. So there is some good, some evidence that's showing that gene testing, and I don't know whether this includes PSA as well, diagnosis, I suppose.
I think, you know, PSA definitely plays a wonderful role in this, because PSA allows people to come forward, and then PSA can be used for monitoring despite the criticism of PSA. PSA is actually a very good test in monitoring progression. And the drop, I'm not surprised, but one of the key criticism people make is, are we over-treating? This is a problem, that the drop might be because we're treating many, many, many more people who are not necessarily going to run into problems.
Yeah.
And that's a key issue here. We can't identify who really needs treatment or not. So I'm surprised they only say 20,000 number of, you know,
20% of the population.
Of a population. Mm-hmm. But you might be over-treating so many more to reduce that 20%.
Right.
So, you know, over-treatment is one always the key criticism when it comes to prostate cancer.
Over-treatment meaning also over-diagnosis.
Over-diagnosis, over-treatment. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the research will give us the answer, who are the one who needs treatment and who are the ones who don't. And then we're hoping that genetic test will be the right thing to do.
Okay.
So, I mean, obviously we asked, you know, Klang Valley about this key issue. Modern medicine, source of anxiety, or the actual source of certainty? What's your view, Mira?
I'm totally against it.
No, I know. You're not against modern medicine.
No, I'm not against modern medicine.
So my question is, modern medicine.
I have to say yes, because I have you all on the show.
That's right. Okay, because I'm not exactly, you know, it's like kind of like a, you know, dark ages medicine.
No, I am very for modern medicine.
Well, okay,
yes.
Right. So do you think, you know, something like, obviously because of modern medicine, we have PSA. Because of modern medicine, we have something like genetic testing. So at the end of the day, it is an art of probability, or science of probability. So by doing that, you will create one group of people who will definitely benefit from it, but another group of people who may have, anxiety because you fall into that grey area. So do you think that it's more at the moment generating certainty or anxiety?
I think it's bringing about more anxiety, because I know a whole load of people who go into gene tests for heart disease, for a whole load of other things, and you have false positive results, you have false negative results. It's a crazy world out there, and I'm thinking to myself, just don't even do it. Professor, I heard your presentation at one of the health conferences, and you spoke about the SNP test, and I think that was really quite interesting. Maybe you just want to very quickly tell us what the SNP test is, and where, for an example, gene testing for BRCA genes, for an example, where does that stand against gene tests for other diseases?
Okay, so what is a SNP? A SNP is, or a SNP, mm-hmm. is called a single nucleotide polymorphism. That's a bit of a jargon. Essentially, it just talks about very common things that are mutated or altered that is very common in the population. So a SNP may be present in 1% of the population, may be present in 30% of the population. That means 30% of us have got exactly the same mutation that is different from the remaining 70% of the population. So these are very common. The issue that I have with SNP testing is that there are some SNPs which are being used for research to identify groups of individuals that or genetic loci that are linked to where the disease gene might be. So you can use this as a flag, if you like, to say, hey, there's something in this region that's linked to
that's
disease,
right.
And that helps you to identify the disease-causing gene.
See, the region is what I'm concerned
exactly.
about.
Exactly. But
the region can be anything.
But that region is not necessarily going to cause an increased risk to disease by itself. And therefore, it's usually multifactorial, multigenetic in nature. The real issue that I have is SNPs are incredibly helpful as a research tool to help us identify genetic loci that are linked to disease so that we can figure out the mechanism by which these genes cause an increased risk to disease, so that we can then figure out how it is that we can prevent disease from happening or develop better ways of treating the disease. But what's happening immediately is many companies are using the SNP test to offer it directly to a patient and say, on the basis of the SNP test, you have an increased risk to disease. And this is where there is a lot of miscommunication, because they'll say you have an increased risk of 1.1 increased risk, a 10% increased risk. Most people, when you say you have a 10% increased risk, you read it as a 10% risk.
Yes.
There's a difference between, so I'm going to say that again, there's a difference between a 10% increased risk and a 10% risk. 10% risk means 1 in 10 chance I'm going to develop disease. 10% increase in risk means if my original risk was 3%, 10% increase is 3.3%. is really going from 3% to 10% is very different from going from 3% to 3.3%. So I've certainly had one of the breast surgeons who worked very closely with us had a GP who wrote to her and said, you know, my wife who had breast cancer, or actually this particular instance was his wife had an ovarian cyst. It wasn't even cancer, was recommended for SNP testing, and the doctor at this particular center told her that she had a genetic alteration that puts her at increased risk of breast cancer. So she didn't even have breast cancer. She didn't have ovarian cancer. She just had an ovarian cyst. And she was told that she needed a mastectomy. So the results came back to me and I looked at the mutation and it turned out that it was just a SNP. And that SNP just increased her risk very, very slightly. And it so happened that this particular SNP is present in 50% of the population. So she's been absolutely given the wrong information, sent very, very scary information about having to have elevated risk and mastectomy was discussed and so on. And that was absolutely the wrong information.
Oh, I am so glad that, you know, to be fair.
Now do you know why I'm against this?
No, no. To be fair, I you kind of lost me halfway. but
pay
you know.
Focus,
George. No, focus, yeah. But the only thing that I'm glad of, in urology, SNP is only vasectomy. That's right. That's the only SNP test that you do.
So SNP, George.
Okay, all right. Okay.
SNP.
All right.
So I think the key difference is you need to know exactly what type of genetic mutation you're talking about.
Yeah.
If it's a gene that we know causes, even in the BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene, there's some genetic changes that cause an increased risk, some genetic changes that cause a moderate risk, and some genetic changes that are not associated with an increased risk.
And also
all.
The interpretations of that increase,
honest, if I had a moderate increase in risk, I'd be horrified.
Yeah. When we had a geneticist, our in-house geneticist here, and we asked that, he had done all these batteries of tests, and then he said, you know, my risk of developing colon cancer is X percentage. And we asked him, what does it mean? It's quite a difficult thing to quantify
It's all probability.
It is probability, isn't it?
So then the question is, Professor, who should come forward and do these tests? You have said family history. So what does family history mean? I have an aunt, my father's sister, who did, die of breast cancer. Does that mean I'm at an increased risk? How would you describe risk?
So for breast cancer, it's a little bit easier in that we have a lot more data. So BRCA1 and BRCA2 are the most tested genes worldwide. More than, I think, 2 million people have had a test for BRCA1 and BRCA2 so far. So for those, then we know that we kind of set our threshold at about 10 to 15%. And the way you qualify that is if you have someone in your family with very early onset breast cancer, typically under the age of 40, or if you have multiple cases of breast cancer in your family, so for example, two individuals diagnosed under the age of 55, mm-hmm. or if you have one individual that has breast or an ovarian cancer in the same individual, or one breast and one ovarian. These are examples of what we will look for as in families that in which individuals have got more than a 15% chance of having a genetic alteration. If you have that and you're concerned about what you should do about it, and you want to know how often should you go for screening, when should I start screening, how much is my risk? These are questions that you want to have some answers to. Yes, with a lot of probability, there won't be certainties, there'll all be a lot of probabilities, but at least it helps you address, what is my risk? Yes, you ask the question, if my father's sister had breast cancer, what is my risk? A genetic counselor can actually help you do that. A genetic counselor will be able to tell you what your without doing a genetic test.
Right, to help you make that decision.
What is your probability? What is your risk of developing breast cancer? A genetic counselor should be able to help you do that. And then the second question that a genetic counselor can help you do is determine what is your probability that you inherited a gene that caused you to have an increased risk, and then help you identify what genetic tests you should have as a consequence of
that. Okay, what about for prostate cancer?
For prostate cancer, if you actually have got family members with prostate cancer, and prostate cancer is linked genetically to breast cancer, ovarian cancer, and pancreatic cancer. So knowing your family history is very important. I once did a radio show with a comedian, and she said, how do you find out, family history? While you're doing your low sang, you say, hey, you got cancer. I mean, seriously, how do we
find out? How do the Indians do it, though?
But how do you ask about family history when the reality is, in our community, cancer is the big C?
Yeah.
it is not a disease we want to know about. If you have cancer, you don't want to talk about it until it's treated and gone. And then you try not to, you know, and if you look at our cancer registry, for example, it's struggling from the fact that many of cancer deaths are still not called medically. They're called by a village chief or called by the police officer and so on and so forth. So we don't have accurate data. And if we're only relying on family history, then we are sunk. Family history as a methodology doesn't work. It is our best methodology so far, but it's not robust enough. So if one day genetic testing becomes cheap enough, where we test all patients, that means all breast cancer patients, if currently it costs 5,000 ringgit per patient to have a BRCA1 and BRCA2 test. If tomorrow I was able to say, I can offer it 100 ringgit, is that a game changer? Would that mean that everyone gets tested so that it's part of, you know, you test for estrogen receptor to see whether you need tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitors. Maybe you should test everyone for BRCA to see whether they will benefit from a new or from platinum-based therapies or from PARP inhibitors, or whether they should be informing their brothers and sisters about their risk of cancer. Mm-hmm. Perhaps so far the cost has been the major barrier. And when there are enough game changers, we can reduce the cost, then I think we're really going to have to answer the question, is genetic testing relevant in our population?
Fantastic. I'm going to ask Josh to very quickly conclude before the evening edition team literally kicks us out. Sly says modern medicine thrives on fear. Your thoughts? All and right, how are you going to conclude?
Well, actually, I learned a lot today. It's like, you know, the Jungle Book's author, you know, Kipling once says, a woman's guess is much more accurate than a man's certainty. All right, today, I definitely learned a lot from a lady here.
Googles a lot as well.
That's right.
you can see.
One thing that for sure, okay, right, you know, Osler once obviously said earlier on, like I said, that, you know, medicine is the actual the science of uncertainty, the actual art of uncertainty, but science of probability. With your hard work in CARIF, it only made that science more and more accurate and helped a lot more people with cancer.
Thank you very much for joining me today. Professor Dr. Teo Soo Huang, Chief Executive Officer of Cancer Research Initiatives Foundation, and Dr. George Lee, Consultant Urologist on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.